Why are these knuckleheads buying $5,000 monkey pictures, right? They don't understand that on the inside, it's this vibrant community that comes around that kind of art and then talks about all kinds of things.
Hello and welcome to Polymos Key Characters. My name is Hal Crawford, and the man you just heard speaking is Mark Long, the CEO behind AAA shooter Shrapnel and my guest this week. I found Mark to be a pretty astounding guy, a games industry veteran who made a VR headset more than two decades ago, a former military officer, and an old school gamer who tells it like it is. And how it is pretty interesting, as you'll find out shortly. We cover the basics of Shrapnel, how it's shaping up, Mark's philosophy of integrating the blockchain without freaking gamers out, and why everyone is making a franchise, not a game, these days. Here's Shrapnel's Mark Long.
Hi, I'm Mark Long, the CEO of Neon. We're the developer of Shrapnel.
Mark, thanks so much for talking to me today. I'm quite excited about this interview, especially having reviewed all the material that I can find on Shrapnel, which is a great deal. You've got a pretty amazing trailer out there. You've got a white paper. Everyone's got a white paper. And you've got what I assume is a massive game studio feverishly working on this title. But first up, I think it's always good to start with the simple things. Can you describe the game Shrapnel for me?
Yeah, Shrapnel is a AAA extraction first-person shooter. And we're building on the Avalanche chain and really embracing the ethos of Web3 across the board. So we're not just making it possible for you to NFT some of the objects in the game, but the token, the Shrapnel token, is a governance token. So if you own a bunch of Shrapnel, you will be able to vote on the roadmap of the game. You'll be able to create your own content for the game, mint it, and then blockchain provides the attribution back to you so that we can share revenue to you for your creation. You could do that on multiple levels. You can create your own map, a mod of the game, and include other people's NFT'd objects like an exploding barrel or a rifle, and you'll get rev share for the map as well. Finally, you have this idea of land in the game, but it's highly abstracted. You don't own a finite piece of land that you build part of the game on. Instead, land, for example, may give you the right to host a tournament and raise a prize pool and then take a rate from that prize pool. So we're open to experimenting with every way that blockchain can improve the player experience and not cramming blockchain down your throat or trying to do these egregious play-to-earn grinds that are really just pyramid schemes.
Yeah, I note that you are not too taken with some of the aspects of play-to-earn. In what you said just then, you would say not ram the blockchain down your throat. So do you have a specific plan with Shrapnel to sort of onboard people gradually, or do you hit them straight up front with a use your wallet to log in?
No, absolutely not. You know, the total number of blockchain players is less than a million daily actives. That wouldn't even be like the top, I think, 50 games on Steam or Xbox Live on any given day. So it's a world, and that's worldwide total, right? So the number of blockchain players is really small. So we are going after regular players. And the way to do this is just simply make a free-to-play game that's fun to play. And then as you accumulate NFTs and you get to a certain dollar value, we'll just send push notifications. Hey, if you would just create a wallet, you can have these and you can do whatever you want with it. Because if you put a wallet and KYCing an AML in front of a player at the very beginning, your average player is going, I'm not going to do that. Any friction in free-to-play gets players to bounce out. You start out making the game you want to make, and then you take away everything that isn't fun. That's how you make a fun game. So if you leave stuff that isn't fun in, you're ruining that experience.
Yeah. Mind you, in how you described the game, I would say there was a fair degree of complexity there. Do you expect players will be able to grasp the details of that economy?
We are making a game for core competitive players. So we're going for the more sophisticated audience, 18 to 35-year-old, primarily males, although not by a lot. It's almost as close to 50-50 in that category. But these are people that play Apex and Valorant and CSGO. So the game Extraction is one of the more sophisticated versions of that game. So as opposed to Battle Royale, where I win by murdering everybody else in the level, you win by getting out alive with the most loot. The maps are very large. There's a low density of players, so there's not the kind of frenetic engagement at the beginning of the game. But once you call Extraction, I've got what I want and I want to get out. Then the gameplay flips. Everybody will probably race to the extraction point and try to be the one that gets out alive first.
And the sort of the economic dynamic is you're carrying a bunch of NFTs, you get killed, you drop those, and then you've lost them for good. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's like real money value. So it has a casino aspect to it, right? I don't think you'd sit in front of a slot machine for 2 hours if there wasn't $20 in that machine, right? It's just tedious to sit there and push a button. So we're adding that dynamic, but not everything that you come in with is liable to be lost by you. That would be a disaster. And maybe I paid $100 for a John Wick skin, and I really love that skin. I wouldn't want you to take it away from me. So there will only be certain things in certain categories. And also, if you think about it, as new players come in and you have older players that have developed a lot of skill, you don't want to come in with a bunch of stuff you bought and then have a terrible experience and get beat and have everything taken away from you.
The name Shrapnel has occurred in your working life before, Mark. Can you explain the connection there?
Yeah, I produced a series of graphic novels called Shrapnel with Nick Sagan. He's Carl Sagan's son. This sounds a lot more highbrow than it is, but it's basically the Peloponnesian War in space 500 years from now. And believe it or not, the fiction of the two worlds are connected, although very distantly. And the reason I did this is I am a transmedia producer. I'm actually a member of the Hollywood Producers Guild, but within the guild, I'm one of only a handful of producers that produce transmedia. And transmedia is just a fancy buzzword for designing for comics, movies, novels, television, live action shorts, feature film, all at once. Not that I want to direct, right? But instead, if a franchise is successful, it really helps if you've systemically designed the fiction to be spread across that media so you have a really successful franchise later on, as opposed to, I didn't know The Matrix was going to be a success. And now we have to reverse engineer all the stuff that we kind of painted ourselves into a corner with.
What I'm seeing in the world of blockchain gaming is that the construction of fictional worlds is actually the main business activity.
Yeah, it's community-based, right? Which is the thing that people don't see from the outside. Like, why are these knuckleheads buying $5,000 monkey pictures, right? They don't understand that on the inside, it's this vibrant community that comes around that kind of art and then talks about all kinds of things, including building fiction around characters. So just, I'll digress for a second because you expressed some strong interest in this. The way I approach this transmedia is different than I've done in the past. And the reason is I sat on a panel at the San Diego Comic-Con last summer, and it was a panel of writers, and they were all much more accomplished writers than me, had done Star Wars movies and comics and television and video, some of the most famous video games you've ever heard of. And Matt Hawkins, the CEO of Top Cow, was sitting next to me. And when we were asked by one of the audience members, what advice do you have for a young writer? He said the most interesting thing. And that was, most newbie writers start off focused on the kind of plot or story or genre they want to do. And I think they ignore character too much. Think about all the movies and TV shows or whatever that you love this character, but the movie is completely flawed, right? And I instantly thought of like favorite in that example, Christopher Walken in King of New York. It's a little seen cult film, but Walken's psychotic character in that movie is just so terrific. And so when we designed the world of Shrapnel, it's all character-based. We built out, I think, over 60 major characters, and that will give a writer that comes behind us who's been commissioned to write a novel, for example, the flexibility to mix and match characters and write how they interrelate, rather than, hey, here's the, you're going to write the prequel to the game, or you're going to write the sequel, and you're just locked into something that you may not be as passionate about.
Could you tell me how much of your team is dedicated to the blockchain tech as opposed to the main game mechanic?
About, I would say a third of the team is dedicated to blockchain and the other two thirds to the game. My attitude about blockchain is trying to find novel ways to use the technology to improve the player experience. So it doesn't come from a monetization aspect. And so in order to do that, it feels a lot like, I don't know, circa 2012 when I developed and published a game called Hawken, this gorgeous mech first-person shooter. Back then, you had to assemble all the components you needed for free-to-play. You had to have the equivalent of a wallet. You had to have an account to put money in and out of. You had identity. And then you had all these analytics services in the cloud to track a player, to track their inventory, and to analyze what it was they like about the game. When did they bounce out? How could you get them back in? And none of that was available as a single service as it is today with PlayFab, for example. So flash forward to 2022, it's the same thing. There's no soup to nut solution for Web3 and gaming. You have to cobble it all together. And we realized in doing that, we were potentially building a platform that other developers could use. So we have branded our platform GameBridge, or simply Bridge.
So Mark, I've heard you talk elsewhere about thinking about how kids grow up playing Minecraft and then Roblox, and they have these amazing creative possibilities in those games or those game platforms. And then they reach adulthood or early adulthood, and there's nothing there for them. You're pitching Shrapnel as that place where you can create and be satisfied and have a great community. Tell me about the first mover advantage here. One, do you think Shrapnel's going to be that game? And two, if it is that game, do all of the advantages accrue to the winner here, or is there space for multiple successful blockchain creative universes?
You know, when I was at Microsoft, I ran xCloud, the game streaming service there. I actually pitched it to Phil Spencer, and he committed to it. And so I was on the Xbox leadership team, and Phil's mandate was to be the biggest game company in the world. That's bigger than Tencent, which is an order of magnitude bigger. They do $120 billion a year, and Xbox does like $14 billion a year. So how do you do that? The obvious things you see Phil doing, trying to acquire Activision Blizzard. But, you know, you can't grow just by acquisition. You have to create original franchises. And I would pitch this to anybody that would listen to me. I'd said, look, I'm watching my own boys learning to visually program in Minecraft and then aging into Roblox, which is like the Legos of game creation, and then into Fortnite, which has its own creator mode. And now over 50% of the playtime in Fortnite is creator-based maps. But when you get out of school and you get a job and you're in the core demographic, 18 to 35, there's nothing for you to age into. And I don't think players are suddenly going to, oh, yeah, I don't actually want to make my own games. I think it's the opposite. And it's something I'm personally passionate about, because In my years prior running a studio, even though I was developing games in the studio during the day, I would come home and mod my favorite games of the time. And I would be thrilled if 11 people played my map, right? Or if I got it to work, right? Because earlier days, you did everything through a command line. There's just, for me, currently joyful about making a game you love into your own, getting it to do something crazy like the GTA mods that you see. That's just fun. And I just think that players are ready after graduating from each one of these game platforms to tackle modding at an unprecedented level, like a professional level, using the same kind of tools that we use. But I don't think the learning curve is going to be so steep. If you look at what's happening with text to image AI with Stable Diffusion and apps like Lensa, you're able to just type in a few prompts and you get amazing results, right? Like stunning results. I believe the same thing is going to happen with text to mesh, text to texture, text to level. As fast as these projects are taking off, I believe you're going to be able to just give it simple prompts and get it to do what you really want it to do without having to learn Blender and 3D modeling and importing high-level shader languages. That would be super dope.
One thing that I'd like to specifically talk about is the trailer for Shrapnel, because to me, I think it's 2:44. I was pretty impressed. I sat there going, wow, and then watched a few more times. It's a pleasure to watch. Can you tell me about creating that thing?
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that. You know, when you're a creator like this, believe it or not, in games, you really don't have the kind of fundamental exchange with fans like you do with comics or other media, where you can go to a con and just talk about what you created with people face to face for a week straight. Believe it or not, that means a lot to me that you like it, because I poured everything into that trailer. I got to work with Jerry O'Flattery as a director. Jerry was art director on Gears of War. He was the cinematic director at Riot for 10 years. He's a Hollywood director as well. And this is my third time working with him. Really enjoyed it. And when we sat down, wrote the manuscript for it, we sat down and I said, I want to do this as what he calls a one-er or a one-shot. Like, the camera never cuts away. It's like there's a guy with a mobile phone shooting the whole thing. And he like looked at me like, that's insane, but that's really great. And so that helps, I think, create a sense of immediacy and realism and energy that is the basis of it. I like that it tells the whole story of the game in this very short amount of time. You might not understand everything going on, but you get it. Like, these meteors fall out of the sky. They must be super valuable. You put them in this container. The container produces energy. And then as soon as I have this thing, everybody around me wants to murder me for it.
So that was made using the Unreal 5 engine, and it's getting close to the point where you'd watch a movie like that. You can tell when you look at the face of the character that he's not human, but everything else is smooth as. Is this going to be a disruption to the movie industry? And if so, when?
It already, I wouldn't say it's a disruption, but it definitely is making a difference, right? The Unreal Engine is already being used for what is called virtual production. So if you think about The Mandalorian, and if you know anything about how that was shot, it's shot on a stage where you're surrounded by walls that are 30 feet tall, maybe 70 feet across in circle, and it projects the real-time graphics of the engine onto the wall. So when you look through the viewfinder and you have live-action actors in between the camera and the wall, that's it. They call it final pixel. You're able to see exactly what it's going to look like. And the breakthrough, the panels aren't like a TV or LED panel, fine grain. They're very low res. You walk up to them, they're tiny little LED diodes. And the reason is those diodes can emit a lot more light than a TV panel can. And so it self-illuminates the scene, and that locks the character in. And actors and directors love it, because if you think about green screen, one of the reasons green screen is sometimes disappointing from a character and story perspective is the actors are having to stand there and pretend that they're reacting. So they're afraid to overact. They don't want to like gesticulate wildly when you get the effects in, they look like an idiot. And so they tend to come across as more wooden. But with Unreal running on these panels, they're able to key off of exactly what's happening, what the eye line is, their timing, and everybody, when you're on one of these sets, everybody feels it like, wow, this is going to be really cool when you're on a green screen set. So I have no idea how this is going to look.
Now, just switching to another aspect of the environment at the moment, the collapse of FTX and the fact that blockchain is suffering a bit of a crisis of trust at the moment in the general populace. How hard is that hitting you guys, and how hard do you see it affecting blockchain gaming?
I've been in blockchain since early 2016. And so I've been through two of these winter cycles, and you just have to have diamond hands, man. You can't look at your wallet, and you don't lose any money if you don't sell it. I firmly believe that digital money is a thing, and that anybody who says this is the end of blockchain is high, but it's pretty tough to watch. And friends that have started blockchain studios or are doing blockchain gaming platforms that took a higher valuation, what I would call a vanity valuation, because the market was frothy, now regret it because it looks like they're going to have to go a year or two with the money they've got and won't be able to raise another round because they priced themselves too expensive. Fortunately, we didn't do that. It's based on my previous experience. Don't go crazy with your valuation because you may need to raise money later down the road.
Now, tell me, I'm really interested, Mark, in the how you operate personally over these long periods that are required to develop these games. This is a multi-part question. One is, how long is Shrapnel going to take from beginning to end to finish the darn thing? And then, how do you maintain your creative energy over that long period?
We hope to be on the show floor of Consensus, showing the game publicly. And then shortly after that, we'll release what we call Multiplayer Experimental, or MPX, from the Epic Game Store, like a month later. The final version of the game, the open beta, will come fourth quarter 2024. So it takes about 2.5 years to make a AAA game and get it to an open beta. Some of your listeners might go, dude, AAA games take longer than that. But remember, we don't have to make 40 hours of single-player gameplay or 9 different modes of multiplayer and 20 maps. We're just making one map. So we are completely focused on what I know is the most important thing about an FPS, and that's gun feel. I could tell you, if I start playing a game and I pick up a gun and I step off for 8 seconds, I'll tell you right then if I'll be playing those 2 weeks from now. It's always about gun feel, translation, and then the combat experience, like what frequency, tempo, character it takes. Yeah, games take a long time to make. And from the outside, you only incrementally see leaps forward and how it looks. One of the things that us and there's two other shooters that I'm really looking forward to in this category that are also blockchain FPSs. There's Dead Drop and Off the Grid. Off the Grid has Neil Blomkamp as its creative director. And Dead Drop has, let me get this right, Dr. Disrespect is their creative director on that one. So two very promising games. And like us, they're showing gamers how the sausage is made. And this is radically different than how game developers normally work. We go off and design and work in secret, and only show the game at the very end when it's completely ready and polished. So it's against every instinct we have to be doing this. But if we're going to invite the community in to design the game with us, we can't wait. The game's too far along and then spring it on them and have them go, yeah, that's not at all what we were hoping you were going to do. And on the other hand, you have to be careful about balancing the input of the players, because in our category in particular, a very small percentage of vocal players could drive the game into a direction like where it's just unforgiving, for example.
The other thing that strikes me about letting the community have a big hand in creating is that creating anything is a different skill from consuming it.
Yeah, I don't believe in designing by committee. I know games are made by a huge team, but I think it's a truism. Franchises and movies and games that you love are auteur driven. And an auteur is somebody or a couple of somebodies that have creative control over every aspect of the production. Like, I think that's why you're responding to the trailer in the way you did, because Jerry O'Flattery and I and Nathan at Plastic Wax, we created that together. We didn't ask for all kinds of input or get feedback from the team. We were trying to make what we were excited about. And either it's going to find an audience or it isn't.
Mark, you've had a remarkable career, a lot of it in games, but also in storytelling, filmmaking, and all sorts of things. What was the first video game that you played?
That I played? I can tell you the one that had the biggest influence on me, and that was Doom 2, because Doom 2 was the first 3D game. It was a Raycaster. It wasn't actually 3D. It was a clever trick, but I was just blown away by the sense of immersion, and that just set me off on my career path. I've always developed first-person shooters. I've always been interested in 3D graphics and what's possible.
And you were actually a major in the U.S. Army, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I commanded an airborne unit, and I worked on a seminal networking and simulation project called SimNet. It was actually one of the first uses of the internet. And up till then, simulators were for pilots because they were usually expensive, like $40, $70 million. But as graphic compute power came down, it became possible to make a simulator for a tank crew, right? And then they networked those so they could play together in a virtual battle. And that led to my first job, which was playing war games professionally at a classified facility. It was nuts. We just played World War III. And I got exposed to Silicon Graphics workstations and Sun workstations. And I read the words virtual reality for the first time. And I decided right there, that's what I want to do. I want to make virtual reality games. That was 1991. And so I was at a laboratory in Princeton doing VR research when Hasbro came through. And they wanted to make a home virtual reality system. They saw the success of the Power Glove the year earlier. And the laboratory we were at was a former RCA laboratory. So it was what they call a commercial lab. You could make things there in the lab that could be built in a factory. And so we designed a home virtual reality system. And my partner, Joanna Alexander, and I we landed this $52 million contract in 1991 to make this thing. Of course, we were way too young and stupid to do it ourselves. So they relegated us to be the evangelist for the platform. And we flew all over the world meeting game developers and trying to talk them into making games for it. And on one of the trips, we had the same idea. Hey, game studios are cool. Like, I want to own a game studio. We should leave and own a game studio because we know all about this stuff. And so we started Zombie Studios, and our first three games were designed for head-mounted displays. And then, of course, that didn't fucking happen. There was like, just like the current generation, like nothing's changed except that HMDs are perfect and cheap, and still it's too isolating a social experience. It's novel.
Is that what the problem is? Is the problem that you're just physically isolating yourself?
I think so. It's cool, but it's just not that cool. And people that are obsessed with it, Mark Zuckerberg, are just chasing something that's never going to happen. Most people ask anybody that owns a Quest, when was the last time they played it? And they're like, I don't know, a year ago. It's cool for a couple of sessions. And then it's you know, too socially isolating. It makes a lot of people sick, and they lie about it and say, oh, no, I think VR is awesome. But they get nauseous from it. It's just not going to be a thing. Virtual reality is going to be expressed in a different way with large screen displays, face and gesture, voice recognition. So you're sitting in front of a wall size like theater, TV, and your interactions use AI and GPT-3. For you to have amazing interactive experiences. And that is coming very soon. But you don't have to wear an HMD to do VR. That's all I'm saying.
Now, you're a novelist as well. You've written quite a few graphic novels, but you've just written a normal novel. I noticed that you dedicated that to Joanna also. I don't know the background of Joanna Alexander. Can you tell me why you dedicated Killionaires to her?
Yeah, Joanna is my best friend and business partner for over 25 years, and we fought many a heroic battle and had many a humiliating defeat together in the game industry. And the book is all about our experience in the game industry. There's a grain of truth in everything in that book. And it's you're finding very profane and hopefully funny and nuts. And if it wasn't something that happened to her, it's some story that somebody told me. And I wrote the book, like a lot of people took up baking or writing during the pandemic. I wrote the book during the pandemic, and I just love the story. I still laugh out loud from some of the scenes in the book, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah. Mark, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention about shrapnel or your experience or your observations of this crazy environment that you're working in?
I think I want to say two things. First of all, I really appreciate you having me on. I really appreciate you doing such deep research. And I want to say I never met an Aussie I didn't like. And that's true. The second is, this is just a game that we're all really passionate about making. And I think when you come from that place creatively, something great is going to come from it. But if it doesn't, I just hope that we're pointing regular players towards the idea of digital ownership in gaming. Players are up in arms against NFTs and blockchain for some really legit reasons. One, do not fry the planet by mining your layer one. How about that? So we're using Avalanche because it's carbon neutral. Number two, it's a lie that you can buy an NFT and take it to other games. They're not interoperable, and there's no real business model that provides for that. So stop saying that and stop telling people you can quit your job driving a taxi and earn money playing a video game. And instead, think about, like, I used to go to GameStop with a couple of PlayStation games I was done with, and I would trade them in. I'd get maybe $15 and I apply that to a new game. And I was happy with that transaction. I didn't care that they turned around and sold them for $25 each. I got some value in what I invested and got it back. Or if I didn't trade it in, I had that value stored in the disc that I had at home. But that went away in the rise of free-to-play, with now 85% of purchases are in-app. But you never really own any of that. And indeed, Ethereum was created when his character was nerfed so badly. It's like, this sucks. So I put all this time and money and energy into this character, and then you nerf it like this. I want digital ownership. And that was part of his inspiration. And it's definitely part of my inspiration to give ownership back to players for what they're paying for.
Mark, thanks a lot for coming on. Thanks for speaking to me as part of my second podcast for Polymos.
Thank you, Hal.
I really enjoyed this one. Let me tell you a couple of extra things by way of context. One, I had to take out all Mark's swearing because I filed this podcast as clean in Apple Podcasts, and that was a shame. Two, Mark is probably one of the most high-profile people I approached to be interviewed on this podcast. I wrote him an email and he wrote back immediately saying, yes, what time do you want to do the interview? I really appreciate that. Three, please subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, head to polymos.io. I sometimes say it Polymos, sometimes say it Polymos. But anyway, polemos.io, and subscribe to my newsletter as well. My name is Hal Crawford. Bye for now.